you were telling me about the basis of Hatfield.
Hatfield rests over fairly porous sands and gravels. So without a high water table, it wouldn't develop into a raised mire, apart from the fact that landscape had already become heath before it moved over towards wetland. So you get the development of a litter layer over the sands and gravels, a heathland litter layer, progressive acidification, and the development of nuclei of bog. On thorn, it's different. It sits directly on Lake Humber clay silts. Increased freshwater runoff leads to the flooding of oak forest and the death in situ of the forest. You don't see that forest on Hatfield. And their trajectories are different from then on. They are very different places.
So we're actually talking about the edge of Lake Humber. Can I see it in terms of, you know, the lake and the shore almost?
No. I mean, there's no lake at that stage at all. Lake Humber's drained 10,000 years before, pretty well. Mm-hmm. We're right in dating.
Am I being too simplistic in the terms of that's where we're at? That Thorn is actually where the lake was, and Hatfield is.
The Lake Humber clays only underlay the northern edge and the Idle Valley to the east of Hatfield Moor. So the big problem of using this term shore, people immediately think that it's a contemporary lake. In terms of the deposits, yes, you're right.
Yeah.
But
Hatfield's always been dry land.
Hatfield develops from heathland to raised mire, and whereas Thorn goes from oak forest, or in fact it goes from lime forest on the Thorn water side, it is through oak forest to wet oak alder forest to death in situ of that forest. The development of fen through poor fen to raised mire, which becomes independent of the water table, and both bogs are then fed by, largely by rain. Mm.
Can you just tell me how you found that out? I'm thinking in terms of just tell me how you found that out.
Well, it's not just me, it's a lot of people working on this, but that without human interference, the natural succession over much of lowland Britain would lead to raised mire, and there would be floodplain mires as well, which would also become progressively more acidic as they became independent of the water table. It's a habitat which has virtually disappeared in this country. There's nothing like it. Thorn and Hatfield were the last remnants of those extensive mire systems in Britain. They're gone now, and we'll never recreate them.
Why did it disappear throughout the country? They were the last ones.
Well, drainage and peat cutting.
Human activity.
Yes. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. They were sufficiently big to survive areas in the Somerset Level also. So, and there are little pockets here and there, but they were the last areas of extensive mire. And of course, we lost a lot courtesy of Fison's and his successors.
Are there any parts of the moor that retain useful records?
There are in the areas at the north end of Lindholm Island, there are successions which must come through to the relatively recent period. That is, the last 1,000 years or so. Elsewhere, we have records which are Bronze Age, late Neolithic, and that's it. But it doesn't mean they're not likely to yield new information. I think I could probably guarantee that if I went out and started stripping the bark off a tree, we'd get another a fossil tree. Then we'd get something else which is new to Britain. I think we've only just scratched the surface. We have concentrated on the beetles, but there are other groups. Pete Skidmore made the point that there were burrowings in some of the pines, which looked like an ant Camponotus. That's restricted to Scandinavia to the present day. It's here in the Lake Glacier. It may have survived through on former Hatfield Moor right through into the Bronze Age. So there's a lot which we really need to do.
But even so, there are records in the landscape and throughout the peat in parts of Thorn and Hatfield Moors that take us from the beginning of the earth, so to speak, right through to about 1,000 years ago.
There are records for between 4,500 years and about 1,000 years ago within the peat. There are scattered peat deposits, like the ones below the cover sands, which go back to 12,500 years, and then sites like Finnegan's and these thin peat horizons in these gravel pits to the south. There are deposits which are perhaps 30,000 years, and well, a site at Osterfield, which Jeff Gaunt looked at, produced deposits of the last interglacial 120,000 years ago.
Can I concentrate now on human activity in the area? And not just in Thorn and Hatfield Moors, but in the wider area, in the regional context, so that we can see how they fit within the local. Can you tell me something about later human activity, in terms of, you know, Stone Age onwards?
Yeah, well, there's a significant scatter, on, particularly over on the Isle of Axholme, of polished axes. I think there are seven axes from the Miston Carr site alone. For surviving Neolithic monuments, well, if it is Neolithic, the most interesting is Greenlee Beacon, which has never been excavated. It's a huge great mound which sits and looks out across the levels. And part of that was cut away when they built a water storage system there. And I was told that there was a scatter of flint found where this was done. There are several long barrows, of course, when you come over onto the magnesium limestone outcrop, one or two of which survive as visible mounds. As visible mounds, you can actually see them as structures. Some of those are in quite significant places as well. Hangman Stone Hill, which is between Mar and High Melton. The mound's gone now, but you can still stand where it was, and the view from there shows you the whole of the levels in that boat. You can see the option. See the Pennines over there, so that they are places which sort of seize the landscape.
And what, can you just briefly say what long barrows are?
They're communal burial mounds of the Neolithic period. Yeah. There's a fair scatter of Bronze Age round barrows as well, most of which are only visible as ring ditches from aerial photographs because they've been ploughed out. From the pollen work that Brian Smith did in the area. Extensive clearance starts in the mid to late Bronze Age, and then you go from a landscape of, on the levels at least, of small temporary clearances, and those temporary clearances probably lasted for several hundred years, so it's not really that temporary. But the coalescence of these small clearances into extensive destruction of forest really starts with the vengeance in the late Middle Bronze Age. By the late Iron Age, there's probably no natural forest left in the region. Any woodland that's left is woodland which is maintained as a source of materials for the maintenance of communities. And it is in this late Iron Age that we get these extensive field systems, which you can track from just north of Nottingham all the way up to the Don, and then other systems continuing northwards. They continue in use through the Roman period. There is a major phase of soil erosion which takes place. Well, the one site where we've got a very good date on it is Littleborough-on-Trent, where the Roman town is replanned within the Roman period after extensive. This is all being recorded. As is your phone call, so we now have a record of that.
It's alright, don't worry about that.
Gallery was, yeah. Okay, see you soon.
Can we go back to the Roman period?
Yes, at Littleborough-on-Trent, site which a chap called John Wade and Derek White, you've probably met Derek Riley.
Yes.
Derek and I put together John Wade's work there. shown a an enclosure oblique to the Roman road, which was clearly Roman. And John had done some excavations in the vicarage garden to show that there was an earlier settlement which was orientated with the Roman road. And between the two was a thick flood deposit from the Trent. It was sitting right on the bank of the Trent there. I looked at the town site there, is overwhelmed by flooding in the early 3rd century and is then replanned using a natural gravel mound within the Trent Valley there on a totally different alignment. Now, from Santoff we had evidence of extensive flooding, one site which I dug with the late John Samuels, and then John Sadler, who's now back at Birmingham Geography, did his thesis on looking at the alluviation in the Don. There seems to be a major change in all the river systems within the Roman period, and that we can...
A natural?
No, I don't think it is natural. It's very difficult to be sure, and those who are really into climate will say, well, there's climate change in the early 3rd century. But I think it's much more likely, and we've done work in northern France which shows this as well, that it's agricultural innovation. That they, this is the first time they're using a plough which cuts the root mat. And once you start cutting the root mat of the vegetation, then your soils start to erode. And our present floodplains are very much a creation of that. So we cease to get organic deposition in the Don and in the Idle. And these deposits feather out into the edge of the peatland, the raised mires. We really need to do some more. Again, we need more long sections to correlate these. But the creation of our modern alluvium-dominated floodplains is a feature of forest clearance followed by extensive clearance followed by the adoption of a plough which starts to cut through.
I know that there is, I don't want to call it a theory, but that the northern arm of the Don is actually a man-made construction.
It isn't, yeah.
I
think Jeff's mapping work shows that very clearly. Mm-hmm. If you drive northwards on the M18, you'll note that the road goes into a slight dip just before you come to the juncture with the M62. That subsidence into the former bed of the River Wendt. So the Wendt crosses the Don. That northern arm, the Tunbridge Dyke, it's very difficult to date it, but it's one of two. There are two other major river diversions. There's the Bickers Dyke, which takes the Idle out to West Stockwith, and then there's the cutoff, which takes the Derwent directly out into the Ouse rather than through Howden. Howden's where it is because it's on the old Derwent there, and you can track that. If you take the road from Howden across to Selby, you can see as you're coming up to the point where the modern course of the Derwent goes out into the Ouse, you can see, because the beach's drying out within the channel, you can see the path of the old river Derwent. Now, we have a reference to that in an Anglo-Saxon charter, so that diversion must have existed by the 9th century. Bickers Dyke is a difficult place name, but it may be Anglo-Scandinavian. And the Turnbridge Dyke, which is the northward course of the Don, well, it cuts across very clearly cuts across the river Wendt. We have a document which refers to the death of Richard de Hoveden. He dies in Doncaster and he's taken back to Howden for burial. And it looks as if the Turnbridge Dyke is navigable at that time.
And when was that?
That's in the 12th century, late 12th.
1100s?
Yeah, so that channel must have existed by then. It seems very unlikely that a channel cutting across multiple landholdings was likely to have been made in the late Saxon or the early medieval period. It may have been cleared out then. The probability is that those diversions form part of a series of Roman rivers.
Okay. No, the river does.
Whether they're for navigation or for drainage is another matter. It all depends on what you make of a car dike in the same way.
So a lot of Roman activity then in
the... Yes. There's extensive pottery manufacture to the south of Doncaster. It's probably over 100 kilns, I've counted them up recently. And there's a group of kilns which we haven't yet found, but on the distribution of products must lay somewhere to the south of Doncaster in the period somewhere between the late 70s and 120. But the system really takes off in the 140s with the expansion into lowland Scotland. And an interesting, I guess he's an entrepreneur really, a man called Sarius, who's potting at Rossington Bridge. He's using a dye which he also uses in the Midlands, and it looks as if he cuts his transport costs by setting up a manufactory for making mortaria at Rossington Bridge. But the potters there are not just Midland potters. He brings in a group of potters from Dorset to make black burnish ware, and he also makes vessels which are imitating metal vessels, imitating pewter, but their ultimate origin is in the Saintonge region of Burgundy in France. So he's buying slaves to pot for him. I mean, he probably never took to pot in his life, but more than that, he has his trademark on the pots. And there's a group of other potters there. He co-stamps with two men, one called Secundo and another one called Setemurgis. Now, whether they're the people who are actually running the manufactory for Sarius, because we know he's also potting in the Midlands at the same time. And he's the local firm. And then pottery production locally continues through the 3rd century. It's always very difficult to date, but there's another boost to production in the early years of the 4th century. And again, quite widespread production there, certainly as far north as Catterick, and probably as far north as Hadrian's Wall under Constantine. And then the system seems to collapse, and East Yorkshire manufacturers, Ning Valley and Lincoln manufacturers, dominate local use.
Pottery industries be placed where they are? You said to cut down.
With the expansion into Scotland, then Sarius, who clearly has military contracts, needs to cut transport costs, because his main manufacturers are in the Midlands around Manchester, not far from Nuneaton. That's a pretty landlocked place, although they probably use a little river anchor to take material down eventually down the Trent. Rossington Bridge is where it is because it is the northern limit, I think anyway, of the tribe known as the Corioltervi, and the southern limit of the Brigantes. Now, the way taxation works in the Roman period is that you're paying taxes to your canton, to your civitas, and if he crosses that boundary, then he's paying taxes to two different groups. So the probability is that he takes it as far north as he could possibly go within the same civitas, which is the one based off Leicester. And of course that gives him access down the Tawn, out into the Idle and long out into the Don. The thing about moving pot is a bulk commodity, so if you can move it by water, you move it by water. We've got one or two pots actually out of the river further along that you can turn down during dredging, so it does seem as if that was a used river.
So the easiest form of communications would have been by water,
yes.
But not solely.
No. It's also sitting on the Roman road, north-south, coming up from Lincoln, Bawtry, and then northwards. We've got the bridge, in fact, in the bed of the river, River Tawn, crossing the bridge as well. The route came across. It's now, of course, destroyed by the M18, but past Bessica Grange, past the parish church in Cantley, so circumference, which is at an odd orientation, and that orientation is actually at right angles to the Roman road rather than east west, down to Rose Hill, where the two most northerly kilns we know are, in the field to the north of the railway, across the racecourse and down into Bilkeston. And there's a fort at the river crossing in Bilkeston. There's an, must have been an earlier fort further to the east in the Julian Florian period.
And there's some evidence of local roadways, I think, that you found in the Thorn area.
In terms of the Roman period, there is a road which doesn't go down into Doncaster. It's in fact the road across Waterdale and on eastwards, formed by Thorn Road, by Thorn Road out of Doncaster. What's now Edenthorpe used to be Streetthorpe. And the probability is that that name relates to a Roman road, yes. Then the crossing point for the Don Valley is probably a Tudyth Bradholm, in that that's the one point where relatively hard ground approaches the river. There's going to be a fort out there somewhere at Crawl. There are a few finds from Crawl which suggest there is an early. There is then a fort at the mouth of the Don, the old mouth of the Don, that is, at Adlingfleet, and then the next one is Alwintry on the Humber crossing. And they, well, the first phase of those must belong to the 50s. There's a large fortress at Rossington Bridge, and there's a significant number of coins of the Julian Claudian period, sort of 54 to 70. That fort is abandoned with expansion. North, and a fort is north of Doncaster, but there must be another fort to the immediate east of Doncaster, somewhere, well, I guess it used to be International Harvesters, I don't know what that company is now, people who make tractors down there. Somewhere in that area there is an earlier fort than the Doncaster one, and the earlier river crossing, if there was one, then it crosses to Almerholm and then goes northwards up towards Askham, and another fort northwards on the Aire.
Quite a large military presence.
Yes, in the 50s and 60s, there was a legionary vexillation fortress at Rossing. It's a big fortress. It's a base sitting at the northern limits of the Curial Turvey.
And that's at Rossington.
That's at Rossington. Yeah. If you go down the hill to Rossington Bridge, the road goes off to the right into Rossington Village. The field on the left, and crossing the road.
So the area is actually on the boundary.
Yes, and it remains on the boundary in the Anglo-Saxon period as well.
This is when we get the later battles and so on that we.
We've been working on a site at Conisborough, which is producing some interesting data there. And there's a site which we think surrounds the later church, it's a good late Anglo-Saxon church, in Northumbrian style, even though it's south of the traditional boundary. But we have a boundary, a wooden boundary, which is basically the wrong way round, in that the wooden facing is to the outside rather than to the inside of a large ditched feature. And that's, we've got a date on that, which is, puts it into the very end of the 6th or the early 7th century. And some work we've been doing with David Hayes and the historical site and the archaeological unit here at Arcus. And the history of that site is interesting because there's a Roman villa down in Clifton Park, which becomes Conisborough Parks in the post-medieval period. It's the park associated with the castle, Deer Park. But the positioning of Conisborough itself, not the castle, but the church site, is probably dictated by an early burial. Burials which belong to either the 5th or 6th century, and you can see that becoming an inverted commas sacred site. Whether this enclosure we've got relates to the southward expansion of Northumbria, or it's something a little bit earlier, and may relate to possibly a monastic site which is taken over by expanding Northumbria, don't yet know. Very contentious, but it's interesting environmental evidence, because when we first looked at the environment, it looked like a deer park. good omens of big old trees and fodder adjacent to the spring. Well, you could just see this structure as being a deer loop and designed to get deer into the park. We thought we'd get dates in the 11th century. We have three radiocarbonates with dendro evidence, all showing that it belongs to this early Anglo-Saxon period.
You made a find, or William Bunting made a find, that you...
We had an area on Thornmoor when it was being extensively drained by bisons. They cut through a rough timber structure which formed a rough platform at the base of the peak. Whether that's a linear feature or a rough hunting platform for hunting from, don't really know. We didn't pick it up anywhere else. And it consisted of not really shaped timbers. I mean, they were just timbers brought together to make a rough, flat area, which had large oaks at the bottom, some alder, and then there was birch on top of that. It's much more interesting in terms of its beetle fauna than the little bit of archaeology that's with it. No artifacts. So.
Why is it interesting for its beetle fauna?
It produces the most recent old woodland or forest assemblage from Britain. I think we had, was it 7 species which are now, and Nicky's built on this quite considerably, which are now no longer found in Britain, and the remainder of the fauna, about 20% of it, would be red datable species now.
So does this allow you to date it?
No, it doesn't. We've got radiocarbon dates which show that it's about 3,000 years old. That's why I say it's the most recent assemblage of an old forest. We're looking at what the forest was like with relatively limited human impact. The process of flooding is due to human impact, so it's not quite as natural as one would like. But it gives us an image of a forest which is perhaps something like the surviving areas of woodland in places like Iwerski in Poland.
What did William Bunting find physically?
He just found large timbers being pulled out of the. They were using an overarm digger to cut these ditches to drain the peat before peat cutting. And he found that there was a concentration of timbers there. And he rung us up and said, "You've got to come and look at this." And he was sufficiently insistent for us to go and look. And the work starts from there. Really.
And how much was exposed? What could you see?
Oh, we only got a section. We cut the ditch section back by a couple of metres, and we opened up an area which was probably about 10 by 2 metres.
10 by 2 metres?
Yeah.
Is that a single thing that you found, or did you find other things associated?
There are no associated structures now. The forest in that region, the large oaks clearly have been burnt. Whether that's man-made or natural fire is another matter, but we're again dealing with a moribund area of woodland. The trees are not really starting to die because of the rising water table.
Do you have any idea of an interpretation of what it might be, what it's for?
There must be some pathway across between the island at Thorn and the area around Crawl, the northern end of the Isle of Wight. It could be that. It's not the pathway I'd use. I think I'll go to the levees along the old Don, which of course flow eastwards between Thorn and Hatfield Moor, and then northwards through Crawl and out to the Trent at Adlingford. We can't do a full landscape reconstruction over any area for the late Bronze Age there. The alternative, if it's not a continuous structure, is that it's a hunting platform. We tend to forget just how much game there was, and particularly in terms of bird life. These skies are now virtually lacking in birds, but they would have been blank with birds in prehistory.
Why would they need a platform?
If you're trying to keep your feet dry while you're shooting game, platform's quite useful. And particularly if it overlooked a pool or something like that. I mean, it's like a duck decoy in the post-medieval period.
Can you just make a comment about how that relates to the the other trackway that's been found on Hatfield Moor?
Well, the answer is not at all. The Hatfield Moor trackway is 1,000 years or more older and is a much more competently constructed structure. And it uses poles of pine laid across rails. There must be a site within Lindholm Island which we haven't yet found. I mean, there's been a lot of destruction on Lindholm Island recently with the digging of this pond, and I walked that area.
A time period, and I'm just beginning to wonder when your interest and work actually runs out, basically. And I wondered how much you more there was that in the area that you were.
Well, it doesn't run out because I work with Pete on modern faunas as well. We added a species to the British list by some work we did out at Sutton Common.
Can you see? The evidence of the 17th century drainage?
We've not got any well-dated insect faunas from that. Lake Maureen Gurning worked on faunas from the medieval moat at Cowick. Bit of a disaster, really. Scheduled ancient monument, and English heretics, or rather their predecessors, allowed the moat to be dredged, because they said the schedule only covered the interior of the moat. And Malcolm Dolby supervised, he was allowed to watch the process, and he managed to recover a column of samples, and Maureen and I went out there and worked on the material. And she then wrote that material up. James Gregg worked on black macros, and it's all published in the Yorkshire Archaeological. Quite an interesting fauna. It includes a couple of species which are, again, are old forest species. But these are surviving, of course, in these individual old pollards within the park associated with the moat. We've not really looked enough at post-medieval faunas. And that's a gap we need to fill, because, of course, those sites are drying out.
I know that Hatfield Chase was a hunting park in the medieval period, and there's evidence for that also.
Yes, I mean, the Carrick evidence is part of that, because Carrick is on one edge.
Yes, I thought it was quite right. That's it. Got
you.
Come on, dude.
You're an awkward cat, aren't you?
Go on, sorry, I interrupted
you. Of course, you won't sit on me if I...
I just don't want to... that's it. Delete everything that we've just done. That's all. That's lovely. Good girl.
I'm back in.
That's fine. We were talking about the medieval park at Hatfield Chase.
Yeah,
and the evidence for that.
Yeah. Again, as I say, apart from the work at Cowick, we haven't really looked at many faunas there. Mark Dinning, who's another Sheffield student, he looked at the deposits from adjacent to Sutton Common and looked at samples which must have belonged to the late medieval or post medieval period. And again, there were a few interesting species, including the great silver diving beetle, Hydrophilus punctatus. That became extinct in the area probably in the 19th century. But it would be quite interesting to try to fill that gap. Harry Kenwood up in New York has done some work in that period. But there is a need to do quite a bit more to look at the medieval landscape. We tend to think that we know what it looked like, and we don't really.
Mm.
Not in terms of the detail of the landscape. Anyway, one project which, in fact, the money from Edinburgh Oil and Gas, we're going to use some of that with Ben Geary to look at retting bits, because, of course, this retting of hemp and flax was a major industry in the post-medieval period, and the curve for cannabis, which of course is hemp, in the pollen diagrams that Brian Smith did, rises in the late Saxon period to a very significant level. So that's an industry which takes off in the late Saxon period.
That's in the edges into the Isle of Axholme area.
Yes, yeah, but there are retting pits which come right down, certainly quite close to the course of the idol, which we've and a chap called Mike Felsey did a lot of aerial photography back in the '60s in that area, and he kept getting these rectangular pits which didn't seem to bear much relationship to the post enclosure landscape in terms of field boundaries and the like. So I guess they are pre early 19th century. And Keith Miller's pointed out place names like the Rates.
Mm.
And we're going to go and try and sample some of those pits. I've been to look at one or two of those sites with Keith, and I need to go out there with Ben so we can get this work moving.
Mm.
It's the usual thing of trying to coincide in the field.
I'm conscious we've been talking for a long time, and so I don't want to keep you much longer. I just wondered if you could say something about the importance of these two Thorn and Hatfield moors. Why they're important, and you know their significance in regional, national, and maybe even international terms.
Well, these Eastern English bogs are different from anything we've got further to the west. They look much more like bogs in the Baltic region, and the beetle fauna includes elements which would be much more at home to the east rather than to the west. So, despite the fact that basically wrecked by the peat industry, there are still enough elements there to make them unique. We've lost all the Raves Myers elsewhere, as I said before. There's no Raves Myer in the Fen, for example, even though there was through into the 1900s, it's all been cut away.
This is unique in Britain?
The problem is that any locality is unique. The assemblage is not going to be duplicated elsewhere, and you have to decide, well, does this contain sufficient unique elements to make it internationally significant? Yes, it is internationally significant. In terms of, well, the breeding populations of nightjars, for a start, we're right out at the normal limit for them. In terms of the beetle fauna, there are species which are only found on Thorn and Hatfield, and Pete's work with flies shows the same thing. What we do with the fossil record is to look at the trajectory which has led to the present landscape. And one hopes one can use that to inform future conservation strategies. Very rarely done. Ecologists tend to think that 25 years is a long time. They don't need to know anymore. The present solution which is being adopted is an engineer's solution. Ironically, they're paying huge sums of money to the people who destroyed the bogs in the first place to put dams back in the ditches which they've cut. There is a major problem because of the pumping down of the water table for Hatfield Moor. The chances of getting that back to being a decent wetland in a low rainfall area are relatively slight. And some heavy-handed strategy is required to reduce areas like Four Peas from being hawthorn scrub back to heathland. I mean, I'm in favour of burning autumn, but the use of fire as a management tool is looked on as anathema. Whatever you create is going to be something new, and it's going to be something which is unique. It doesn't mean that it's nonetheless interesting. The peat bodies which have been cut off consisted of a species of Sphagnum imbricatum, which is now extinct in Northern Britain, a few upland localities. I've looked at it growing in the Baltic, in fact, and I've looked at bogs in the Baltic which would have been what Thorn was like, say, 2,000 years ago. We can't go back to that. But it's an interesting exercise to see what you can do. I mean, we're not going to live long enough to see that. And one of the big problems that conservation has is that you know they want immediate returns, quick fixes. It doesn't work like that. It'll go to poor fen in much of the wetland areas because there's too much nutrient. And also you've got the problem that the atmosphere is different. You've got all those ring of power stations raining out sulfur on it. The nitrogen levels are too high. So you can get lots of money spent on